Support for TPR comes from UT San Antonio, offering degree programs and research focused on workforce development, student success, and health innovation across Texas. UTSA.edu. UT San Antonio, the University of Ambition.
Welcome to Fronteras, a program that explores issues at the border and beyond through the lens of arts, culture, and history. I'm Norma Martinez with Texas Public Radio in San Antonio. The peaceful cold morning of January 28, 1948, was pierced with an explosion, screams, and a crash. The crash happened in western Fresno County, California, in an area known as Los Gatos Canyon. Witnesses who lived nearby, as well as inmates from a nearby prison road camp, recall seeing and hearing people flung out of the aircraft when the explosion tore off a wing. Those unfortunate souls who remained on board were no longer recognizable as their mangled remains became one with the twisted, fiery wreckage of the plane. The plane was a contract flight for the emerging deportation flight industry. Aboard were the four crew members and 28 Mexican nationals who were being flown to a deportation center. They were likely working as braceros, harvesting crops in the Central Valley of California. The news of the crash made headlines across the country. The 28 deportees, as they were called in the articles, were buried in a mass grave with no identification. Legendary folk singer Woody Guthrie immortalized the passengers' anonymity in his song Deportee.
Oh, the sky plane caught fire over Los Gatos Canyon, a fireball of lightning that shook all our hills. Who are all these friends who are falling like dry leaves? The radio said they're just deportees. Goodbye.
Their identities remained hidden for decades. Writer and poet Tim Z. Hernandez learned about the crash when he was searching for B. Franco, the Mexican girl written about by Jack Kerouac in his 1957 novel On the Road. That path led Hernandez to a search for the passengers' identities to resurrect their names and bring their families some sort of closure. Hernandez wrote about his search in the 2017 book, All They Will Call You, and the 2024 follow-up, They Call You Back, A Lost History, A Search, A Memoir. Hernandez discovered during his nearly two-decade search, it was the stories and the spirits of the passengers and their families who were searching for him.
These specific searches have been the last, almost the last 20 years of my life, but I've been searching for people since I was a child, you know, and I think that that definitely had a major influence in what has pulled me into these stories, or at least put me in the right position to be someone, maybe the person who is being sought after by these families, you know. I have understood grief in my family for many, many years since I was a child. My mother's side especially shared so many stories of their grief with me. And for some reason, growing up, that grief was always tied, linked to some kind of someone missing or some search that it required some search. You know, it was like that when I was a child, as you've read in my book. And then as I became a teenager, we were searching again for an uncle who was, you know, lost. And so there are all these searches happened. I was actually, you know, reading Jack Kerouac's book. And suddenly I discovered that, you know, there's a woman in this story. And that's kind of what begins to pull me along. I think just being positioned in the right place at the right time and having these experiences are what made me open to these ideas and open to the possibility that one could go searching for people at all, because we read a book and we don't think twice about it necessarily. We read about a story of someone missing and we don't think we could be the one searching for them. We just kind of go, oh, that's sad. But for some reason I think the tools and experience to say, why not me?
These searches for these passengers, you kind of had to start at ground zero, and you write that you really didn't know how to start. And I don't think many people really do. And I don't know if, I mean, obviously the internet was around, so there were ways you can, you know, look things up. There are libraries, but what was maybe that one piece of evidence that you were able to find that kind of justified that you were on the right track and that you were going to proceed in this goal of trying to find family members of these passengers who had been identified in at least one newspaper article, but most American newspapers just called them 28 deportees.
Right. Well, the first scrap of evidence was a newspaper that had the information, but how I came to find that newspaper was what I think was really a journey of synchronicity and just luck. Because I, you're right. I, you know, let me just first say that when I went to college, it was not for investigative journalism. It was, I went to study poetry all the way through. I'm a poet, man. You know, I was like, I'm just, that's my thing. And so I was just very green at this whole research process, investigative process. So I just followed my instinct, to be honest. I just followed my blind curiosity. I was just like, I'm going to let my curiosity take me wherever it needs to go. And maybe if anything, that's the good thing that poetry has taught me was, you know, follow that curiosity. And so I did. And it led me to all these sorts of places. You know, I was knocking on the cemetery director's door, asking if he knew information at the Hall of Records. I was just kind of exploring and allowing myself to freely roam and explore because I didn't have any goal in mind. That's important to say. I didn't think, oh, this is going to be a book and there's a timing involved. And I just was like curious, just I'm a curious guy going around looking for stuff, for information. And, you know, and that's why I found the plane crash site itself. And I just kind of would knock on doors in the canyon and talk to people. Have you ever heard about this plane crash? And, oh, so-and-so, Miss so-and-so is still alive and she remembers. And, you know, it's just very exploratory in that way. And finally, after about 2 years of doing that, I sort of gave up the search because I knew I wanted to find, I had to find one of the families of the passengers, some descendants, but I couldn't. I had no information how to find them. And so I kind of surrendered the story to the universe and I shared it with a journalist, a reporter by the name of Juan Esparza from the San Joaquin Valley. He has a bilingual newspaper at the time called Vida en el Valle. He shared that story in that newspaper. And 3 weeks later is when I got a phone call from Jaime Ramirez. And he said to me, I have an uncle and a grandfather who were killed in that plane crash. Let me know if he'd like to speak with me. Now, check this out. I've been searching for 2 years at that point. I said, where can I meet you, Mr. Ramirez? I'd love to come and talk to you. And he said, at my restaurant. And I said, where's your restaurant? He gave me the address. And I said to him, my gosh, is your restaurant Ole Frijole? I said, and he goes, yes. How do you know it? I said, my parents have been taking me to your restaurant since I was a little boy. And so there was a synchronicity. And so when I met with him, he's the one who said, here is this newspaper my family has had for 70 years at this point. And I said, what made you keep it all these years? And he said, we've been waiting for you, hermano. And he gave it, handed it over to me. And that's the newspaper I've used to find all these families over the last 16 years.
I mean, and that's incredible. Just again, it's almost like they are finding you. And you even write about seeing sort of these apparitions. It's just them calling you. And so it's just really interesting to hear about these, you know, really serendipitous interactions that you've had with families. And that's also got to be a race against time also, because there are only so many family members who are going to continue telling the stories of the passengers before their time is up as well.
Yeah, that's right. It is a race against time. And that's something I learned in the process. Again, I'll restate, I've been doing this for 16 years now on this search, and I'm still going. I found about half the passengers at this point. And I think what happened is, you know, you mentioned the sort of the spirits that have come to me. You know, since I was a child, my grandparents, in our culture, in nuestra cultura, that's just how things are. We believe in the power of dreams, dreams crossing into the real world and vice versa, real world crossing into the dream world, right? And so what happened was I was reading Yeats one day, and I realized how he had often was kind of like this by any means necessary approach to literature. And he was like, you know, summoning ghosts and spirits. And all of a sudden, it, you know, not that I would do that, but what happened is reading his book, it felt like it gave me permission then to go, wait a minute, Tim, this is your experience and your culture and where you're from. Like, utilize everything you've got as a possibility. You don't know where these families are. You don't know where the messages or clues are coming from. So assume that everything that comes is a clue or a message. And that's what I start to talk about in the book is how you know, I would have very vivid dreams that would cross into when I'd wake up and see things. And I started to just really tell myself, is this a clue? And if so, how? Is this a clue? And if so, how? And I use that as much as I used, you know, real data and information I was finding, you know, records and documents and things like that. I was just kind of bringing it all into the giant box I had. So, you know, for me, that's always been a part of the process. But again, really just kind of being open to it. I have this really, this strong belief that when you send art out into the world, it has a gravity, you know, in and of itself. And so for me, I sort of believed in that and have followed that through.
Tim Z. Hernandez is the author of several poetry collections and the books All They Will Call You and the 2024 follow-up They Call You Back, A Lost History, A Search, A Memoir. Hernandez is also currently in post-production for a documentary about his search for the Los Gatos Canyon plane crash passengers. It's a story he wanted to hand to the right producers.
This story is so precious to me because the families I've searched for aren't just subjects. They're like my family members now. They're people who I've gone and celebrated quinceañeras and weddings and spent the nights at their houses. And, you know, they really look at me like family and vice versa. So I felt like it was so precious that I didn't want to just give it to somebody who wasn't really aligned or invested in this kind of story.
Our conversation continues next on Fronteras.
August is Make-A-Will Month, a great reminder that the decisions you make today can have a lasting impact tomorrow. By including Texas Public Radio in your will, you'll help ensure that trusted journalism, meaningful storytelling, and fact-based reporting remain available to future generations. Your legacy can help keep our community informed, connected, and engaged for years to come. To learn more about creating a legacy gift to TPR, visit tpr.org/legacy.
Welcome back to Fronteras. I'm Norma Martinez with Texas Public Radio in San Antonio. Author and poet Tim Z. Hernandez says he's been searching all his life. His most publicized search is for the families of the Mexican passengers who were killed in what was described at the time as the worst airplane disaster in California history. The small charter flight carried 4 crew members and 28 Mexican workers who were being flown to a deportation center on January 28, 1948. Hernandez wrote about his search in the books All They Will Call You and They Call You Back. His search continues on film. Wherever Hernandez was called on his search, he made sure to document everything. Those hundreds of hours of tape will be edited, produced, and released this year in the documentary All They Will Call You. Hernandez says his instinct to record every detail dates back to an encounter over 30 years ago with a cherished mentor.
His name was Juan Felipe Herrera, who became the U.S. Poet Laureate. I was grateful that he was so generous back in 1995 and invited me into his home and took me under his wing, him and his wife and his family. And he taught me, sort of launched me, you know, from there. And the first thing him and his wife would always tell me is document everything. Everything you do, document it. I never heard that. You know, I mean, why would anybody want any documents from me or any record of her? But I took that and ran with it in everything I did ever since. So the moment in 2010, when I began searching for these families on this search, actually prior to that, with you mentioned B. Franco and Kerouac's Mexican Girl in 2008, I had already begun recording. And by recording, I mean, like, it was at first it was an audio recorder. I'd go around with it, and whatever my ideas were, I'd speak into this little digital audio recorder, you know, ideas. And then later on, it was like, okay, I'll bring a little point-and-shoot camera and take pictures. And then it just started to evolve. It was like, well, maybe I'll bring a little handheld camera. So I carried that into the research immediately with All They Will Call You and the plane crash. The other reason, too, is I knew that there was no existing archive of this story of the plane crash at Los Gatos. The only piece of archive we have over the last 70 years is a song written by Woody Guthrie, performed by Bob Dylan, Johnny Cash, Bruce Springsteen, Willie Nelson, everybody like that. That's the only record we had of this story. So I knew that I was essentially creating the record as I was following it. So I started to get serious about it. Well, quote unquote serious, because I had no idea what I was doing. I had my audio recorder, and then I was like, now I'm going to get a really high-powered Sony handheld cam, you know, and I used my money to go and buy that. And so everywhere I would go, I started to carry these things with me. It was like a one-man show. And I just began to record and record every step of the way, from my thoughts to going into the canyon to meeting families. And you can, it's funny because after we sat down to create this documentary, once we sat down to ingest all the, it was over 200 hours of footage that I created over the last 16 years. And I sat down with the producers and the editors, and I suddenly realized you can see the evolution of, oh, Tim, when he didn't know anything about cameras, to, oh, he's learning. Oh, okay. He's getting fancy now. And that's what brought me here. It was a 16-year learning curve.
And so tell us a little bit about the progress of the film now. You had that's 200 hours, and that's where your editors and your producers come in to say, that's got to go, Tim. And you're going to be like, but that's my baby. I can't let that go. It's so important. As a radio producer, I totally understand. Some things have got to end up on the cutting room floor. But how does that process feel for you to have, you know, those 200 plus hours sort of condensed to a more palatable form for audiences?
Yeah, you know, in grad school and writing or writing programs, they teach you to kill your darlings. That's the phrase we use, you know, kill your darlings. So it's like the best line you think you have, you got to just be willing to let it go. And so I'm familiar with the editing process through that way. You know, not everything can stay. But, you know, throughout the years, because I have the books that came out, and a lot of news media has caught on to it and written stories about it, I've been approached by different producers for many years to possibly make this. At one point, it was in development for a film, for a scripted film. It's no longer in development for that. And then it was like producers would approach me about a documentary. And the truth is, over the years, it was like, this story is so precious to me because the families I've searched for aren't just subjects. They're like my family members now. They're people who I've gone and celebrated quinceañeras and weddings and spent the nights at their houses. And, you know, they really look at me like family and vice versa. So I felt like it was so precious that I didn't want to just give it to somebody who wasn't really aligned or invested in this kind of story. And so it took me a while. Lo and behold, somebody only here in El Paso could understand, as I was in conversation with our friend Chuck Horak, Charles Horak. You know, he interviewed me for his show here on film. It's a radio program based out of KTEP. And we began talking, and I approached him and I told him the story. And he just said, I'll help you make it happen. You know, and he's produced other films, and he's, you know, he has his own post-production studio here. And he's just so invested in this type of story. The other producer is Lori Coyle, who you had on your show. Lori is actually somebody who's followed my story for many years. And so I said to myself, one day if I make this a documentary, I'm going to ask if she'll be one of the producers, because she's just so knowledgeable. Her film, Adios Amor, was so influential to me also. And Lori said, yeah, let's do it, Tim. I'm on board. So Lori and Chuck, Charles Horak are the producers, and myself. And then I've hired a lot of really great folks to help come along. One of them being San Antonio filmmaker Ray Santisteban. You know, so we just had a lot of good folks, El Paso, Texas-based people on this project. And now the post-production, we're in the middle of post-production. All of the post-production is taking place right here in El Paso with a whole team that's just done so many great documentaries and films. So it's really exciting that we have a website now, allthewillcallyou.com, or my website, timzhernandez.com. And right now, like I said, we're fundraising. We're actively having meetings going all over the place. Me and the producers talking to people. We're happy to meet with your group. We can do Zoom conversations. We can meet in person. We'll fly to where you're at. We're just doing all of that sort of campaign to raise the money. We're almost there. You know, we're kind of aiming at the end now of this fundraising campaign. We're almost there, but you know, that's what we're doing right now actively. It's just trying to get the right funds to keep the machine going, finish post-production, and get it into the film festivals by this fall. That's the goal.
One thing that I remember reading in your memoirs, you know, this interview that we're doing here, this is part of a way to help you get more attention for your film. And when your books came out, you were being interviewed, as you mentioned before, left and right and left and right. And you mentioned in your book that it really took a toll. And it reminded me of, not necessarily in the same vein, but of Reina Grande, when she writes about having written her immigrant trauma was a way kind of for her to accept it, but having to relive it in retelling audiences was almost re-traumatizing. Is this kind of a vicious circle or loop that you're kind of finding yourself in? I mean, obviously, these searches are incredibly important, and this film is going to
open more doors, hopefully, to find more families of these passengers. But I'm just wondering, how are you kind of able to cope with the extra attention, writing about how you had processed it before?
Yeah, it has been at times daunting and overwhelming. And at times there have been a couple of years here and there where I had to just pull away entirely for the year because it was just so overwhelming, taking a toll on my health, on my mental health, things like that. And, you know, Raina, who you mentioned, who's a good friend of mine also, and just a fabulous, fantastic writer. We're grateful to have her in this country writing at this time, you know. You know, but I think one of the differences about this story, that even though it's born out of a grief, out of a tragedy, which is this plane crash that killed 28 Mexican workers in 1948, all of them annihilated, and then they never got their names. They were just called deportees. And most of the families didn't know whatever happened to them, never got the closure they wanted. And yet, as I would learn, lived all this time with that grief just underneath their skin, you know, with that question, that mystery, whatever happened to my father, my brother, my tío, my grandfather, they all lived with this and are still living with this today. Now, that said, it was an open wound when I entered the story. And I feel like the more I share it, especially with the families, the more the wound begins to heal. And that's one of the things that's different, I think, about this story that makes it unique, is that every time I go around sharing it, there is a healing process that happens. And once I recognize that, there's a closure, not just for the families, but you start to see in audiences who aren't even associated with the story, they start to come to sort of ideas about their own family and their own past. And hopefully it offers them a little bit of light as well. But one of the things I do is, as much as possible, since the books have been out 9 years now, because the first one came out in 2017, I invite some of the families now, the descendants that I found, I invite them with me to different locations to have these conversations so people get to interact with them directly, as well as the musicians who perform this song, you know. And so when I think one of the things I've learned is, and you're probably a big advocate of this, I have no doubt, when you share one story with another person, it can be a sort of medicine, you know. But when you share a lot of stories in a community, it feels more like a transformation. You know, there's something greater happening there, I think. And that's why, for me, it's so important to go around. So I don't get that kind of overwhelming exhaustion that is usually associated with, you know, the weight and heaviness of the story. What I get is, here I am to talk about the redemption, the closure. So I look at it that way, you know, and the families themselves have expressed that over and over. And I'll say one thing. In the documentary, there are so many moments of closure and light and redemption in the story. And we're like, that's what it needs to do. It needs to go, okay, it's born out of a tragedy, but where are all the moments that feel good, that display our humanity at its best, you know? And so we have some of those. That's part of the point of this documentary.
One of the things I thought was really beautiful, you write about being in the California State Legislature and the 70th anniversary of the plane crash. You are there with the families of the passengers and with your son, and you just happen to run into Joan Baez, who is one of the many, many singers who has sang this song. And you write about her actually singing the song to the families, the very first time a song about them has been sung to them. So can you talk a little bit about that moment?
Yeah, the state Senate invited Joan Baez to be there, and she was back in the green room with us before they brought us out to the Senate floor for the recognition. They cleared the room, and it was just Joan, myself, the families of the passengers, and she just sang the song Deportee to them, and it was one of the most quiet, moving moments of my lifetime, but of this song and this journey, you know. And then from there, we held that energy together. Everyone felt tight, and we walked out onto the Senate floor, and then we began to say their names out loud. And then after every name was said, my son, who's 9 years old, began to recite, presente, presente. And everyone looked at this little boy, who's saying that? And suddenly the whole crowd started erupting in the word presente, presente, which is to say they are all here with us now as we say their names. It was a beautiful moment. And that's one of the highlights of our documentary.
Well, Tim Z. Hernandez, has been so great talking to you. We'll talk again soon.
Thank you, Norma, for all that you do. I appreciate it, and take care of yourself.
Tim Z. Hernandez is an author, poet, and associate professor of creative writing at the University of Texas at El Paso. He's the author of several poetry collections and the books All They Will Call You and They Call You Back, A Lost History, A Search, A Memoir. Hernandez's still ongoing search for the families of the 28 Mexican passengers of the Los Gatos Canyon plane crash is documented in the film All They Will Call You. It's expected to start the film festival circuit this fall. See a trailer for the film at tpr.org. Woody Guthrie's song about the 1948 plane crash, Deportee, has been covered many times, and we're going to close out the program with a version recently recorded by Margot Price and Joan Baez. Fronteras editors are Dan Katz and Yvette Benavides. The program is produced by Marian Navarro and Norma Martinez. Charanga Cakewalk composed our theme music. I'm Norma Martinez with Texas Public Radio in San Antonio. Thanks for listening.
Flying back to that Mexican border to take all their money and wade back again. Rosalita, adios, mis amigos, Jesús y María. You won't have a name when you ride.